This is Phil Sertum talking to you from day three of School Sucks across America, coming to you from the mouth of the Pine Barrens in southern New Jersey.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. You are going to be hearing this on October 20th. Now, I'm recording it on Thursday, October 19th. It's about 10:30, and I am just out for a quick walk. I'm talking to you into my Zoom. You know, somebody, a man told me once not to multitask, but after the last 5 days, I'll tell you what, fuck that guy. Because, you know, sometimes you just need to combine activities, you know, to save time. I like to get some walking in every day, and there's been a lot of driving over the pretty much the last, we're approaching the end of the first week here, and, you know, a lot of socializing, and a lot of socializing is done sitting down, you know, unless you're golfing or playing racquetball with somebody, you know, you socialize in seats. So I hope you'll tolerate over the next 40 days, 35 days left. Some compromised sound quality with some of these recordings. Phil and I, my guest today, we did this sitting around a fire, a little bonfire that we made in his backyard. I recorded the podcast that you're going to hear just a few hours after arriving in southern New Jersey. Phil was a great host. We got to spend a lot of time, just the two of us. It was a nice bonding experience, and I hope to have a few of those along the way. One quiet night, and then last night we did the first meetup in the beautiful city of Philadelphia with a tremendous group of guys. We had so much fun. It lasted into the wee hours of this morning. The podcast from that, it was passing three mics between eight people. It was one of my favorite conversations, but I'm still debating releasing it because some of the content is quite explicit. But some of the content is absolutely marvelous, and it was really a good representation of the variety of folks that make up the School Sucks audience. But even though it was different people, different communication styles, different senses of humor, we all got along, and there were some really... for me, powerful revelations in that show. So whether it becomes a podcast or it just becomes a patron show or an AV club show, some of you will get to hear it. And I was really happy with it. And it was a tremendous life experience. And Phil was my tour guide for Philadelphia. Oh, I went and ran those rocky stairs in front of the Museum of Art. I thought that would be my idea. There were 30 other dipshits there doing it too. So... that reminds me, because I said the same thing earlier today in my drive journal. If you are a supporter of the show and you're looking for just a few extra thoughts or tidbits about what's going on, I've been as regularly as I can posting drive journals where I just pick up the Zoom and record in the car. So you can check those out as well. So Phil, a few years my senior, is an executive in a very, very successful family business, glass business. And I got to go and tour and see people blowing glass. I thought blowing glass was an expression. I didn't know you actually sat there with a little blower thing and blew with your own mouth. And then we went over to the machining shop and I got to see all these CNC machines, you know, making things and following the codes on the little screen. It was amazing. It was just so cool. I wish I got more footage of that. But, you know, our conversation included the two questions. After we talked for hours, just he and I around the fire, no one's ears but ours, we set up the recording equipment and we did about another hour. I was really happy with how the conversation turned out. I asked him the two questions that I said I was going to ask everybody, the, you know, your school stuck story and then what did you do about it? And a big part of that is, you know, a person's own self-education journey. And because that is about self-education, I thought I would let people talk if they wanted to about subjects on which they had educated themselves. And in Phil's case, it was cybernetics. So a good portion of our discussion went there. And that explains the title of today's show. So a huge thanks to Phil Sertum. He's today's guest. And to Phil Figueredo, who organized the Philly meetup, and to all the guys there. And it really energized me. I'm excited to get to Columbus next week for the next event. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your enthusiasm and support that you're showing through social media. It's encouraging. Here's my conversation with Phil Serdom. Thanks for listening and take care.
So I was when I was driving down here on the New Jersey Turnpike, I did one of my daily drive journals, and I was talking about interviewing you tonight, and I was saying, well, where did we first encounter each other? And it was just this past April at the Tom Woods event at Yale.
At Yale.
But we've spent, considering the distance we are, we've spent quite a bit of time together since then. We hung out at Pork Fest. Yeah. And then at Thaddeus Russell in Salem. So
excellent time, by the way. That was beyond my expectations, really. It was fantastic. I made a lot of good connections there.
Yeah.
Solidified some friendships that were strictly online up to that point.
Yeah.
With Phil, the other Phil, and Daniel from Ohio, Alex from Ohio.
These are all people coming up in the next 10 days for me. Phil tomorrow. We'll see Phil tomorrow in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome people, man. You really... it's a testament to what you've built with the show, just to see the intelligence level of, especially because these guys and girls are a lot younger than me, and it really was inspiring to me to see how they've used, you know, they've gone outside the purview of the education system to educate themselves.
At a time when it's, you'd like to say that it's easier, but the pressure on people that age to go the standard route, to go to college, kids that age pretty much had their entire public education with the message that you were a failure if you didn't pursue a college degree. And we encountered these brilliant minds. Danny was 21. His girlfriend, I think, was about the same age. Alex was 24. Yes. And, you know, I've ran into a lot of those people through the years because of the show. And I love those stories so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've even found a couple, you know, 14 years old, 15 years old. And they, I mean, one of the first guests I ever had was a kid who got his parents to sign him out of school when he was 14. And he was listening to the show.
Wow.
And I thought that, and I don't think he did it because of the show. I think he found the show because of interest that he already had. We've been talking for a couple hours, and you told me that you only started listening, what, 2013?
13, yes. Yep.
How'd you find us?
Through a series of comedic episodes. Basically, at that time, I was back in the 90s, I was very into William Cooper comes to mind.
Yes, William Cooper.
The Hold a Pale Horse.
Yeah.
Was my introduction to this school of thought. Through a series of events in my own life, I kind of backed away from doing research.
Mm-hmm.
Then at a time in my life when I was obsessed with infantile pursuits, like pop culture fandom, I was a huge Howard Stern fan at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a show with a gentleman from Austin, Texas named Alex Emerald Jones.
Right.
And kind of got into his stuff very hardcore for a couple years. And as I was telling you, he did a film with a mutual friend of ours, a guy named Richard Grove.
Yep.
The film was called State of Mind. I bought the DVD, actually bought several copies of the DVD, and I watched every extra on the DVD menu. And I found myself continuously going back to the behind-the-scenes roundtable that he had with Richard and another mutual friend of ours, Kevin Cole.
Mm-hmm.
And something just really spoke to me. Between the two of them that made me divest from InfoWars and that whole school of thought. Jones has a lot of bravado, a lot of fear-mongering, and just about zero solutions.
Yeah.
And there was just something about the way that Richard and Kevin spoke that really touched me and got me to take it a step further and to Google tragedyandhope.com. At which point, you know, that led me to the Peace Revolution podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a group show that you had done with, they had done with you. It was you, Richard, Kevin Cole, and a certain fellow from Redlands, California.
Okay. Named, yep. That's good.
Yeah. So,
What were we talking about? Do you remember what the subject was?
You know, I should know this because I listened to that show so many times. And Corbett was on the call as well, James Corbett.
I don't even remember this.
I believe
wow.
It was social engineering. I know cybernetics was a subtext in the conversation.
Okay.
I'm sure with the contribution of that gentleman from California, there was probably some talk about the Huxley family.
Yep, sure.
And Tavistock Institute and mind control, which has always been a pet subject of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I had never really gotten much further than the popular books that are available on the subject. Search for Manchurian Candidate, which books that are now considered to be limited hangouts, you know.
What do you mean by limited hangouts?
They were released as damage control.
Okay.
Limited hangout meaning it produced a lot of low-hanging fruit.
I gotcha.
So that people would stop their research then and there and not go any further.
Like a dead end.
Yes, exactly. Sure. Yes, okay. Yes. One fellow whose work I was really into back then, and I still am, is Jim Keith. Do you know?
No.
Mind control, world control. He did some very, black helicopters over America and casebook on alternative three and, you know, all this.
Casebook on alternative three? Yeah. You got to explain that. That's...
Alternative three is has to do with like the secret space program.
Yes,
and,
of course.
You know, how the elites are planning to abandon...
Evacuate, yeah.
...planet Earth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But towards the end of his career, and actually the end of his life, because Jim Keith is dead. He died in 97, 98. He injured his knee at Burning Man and went into the hospital in Nevada and was quoted as saying, if I go into surgery, I don't expect to come out.
For his knee?
For his knee. And that's exactly what happened. He died under anesthesia. So... Yeah, well, it's kind of neither here nor there, but his work was introduced me to mind control. Let's put it that way. So, fast forward to the show that I heard with the one that we had talked about earlier with you and Rich, Kevin, and James Corbett, and gave me a whole new perspective on how to look at the subject.
Right,
and led me into research avenues that I continue to pursue to this day.
So, okay, so you just kind of liked me. And said, oh, you have a show, and I'll listen to that, too. See, the reason, the direction I was going in, I did the first, like, prototype of this interview series this morning with Richard Grove. Somewhat, you know, geographically determined, but also, you know, synchronistically, I guess.
Sure.
Here. And, you know, I said, the things that I want to ask everybody, we kept calling it in the discussion a school sucks moment, but there is no school sucks moment where you realize school sucks or you didn't actually get an education there. It's more like a school sucks story.
Right.
So what I was driving at was, what was it, I guess, about, you know, your life or your quote unquote education that when you first encountered the message of school sucks, that resonated with you. But from what you've told me about this research that you were doing in the 90s and how you came back into this stuff a little over 10 years later, you were already pretty well primed to sort of take on that that conditioning or indoctrination message because it just perfectly fit with a picture that you already had.
Yep, exactly. That's a very succinct way of putting it. Yeah, exactly. So once I, you know, discovered that you had your own show and Corbett had his own show, I took it upon myself to subscribe and been listening ever since because it did resonate with me, obviously, very much so.
What was school like for you?
It was, in a word, it was hell.
Yeah.
It was absolute hell, almost from the word go. I had a very domineering and some would say the last of the corporal punishment believing teachers for my first grade teacher. She did everything to make life hell for me except physically putting her hands on me in a public school.
What was it about you? How did you become the target?
Good question. Maybe she sensed weakness. I've always been described as more of a compassionate type person and kind. And maybe she sensed weakness.
No place for that in first grade?
No, apparently not. I'll never forget, she had a chair that you had to sit in. You couldn't raise your hand. You had to sit in this chair to ask a question.
Okay.
And I had to use the bathroom. And she obviously knew that I had to go to the bathroom. I was squirming in my seat and then in that question chair. And she ignored me until I finally, you know, peed my pants.
Right.
And her response to that was to take my desk and empty it out. You know, those old desks where you can put the books inside and everything.
Mm-hmm.
She overturned that desk in front of the entire room and, you know, everything all over the floor. Books, papers, pencils, crayons, everything. And while I'm, and then forced me to clean it up while I'm in front of the entire class with, you know, wet pants.
Yeah. Where was this?
About five to 10 miles away from here. It's a little town called Norma. It's the next town over from where I currently live.
Wow.
Yeah. She was an animal. She really, really put me through it. My parents had to get involved, and they actually had me switch teachers in first grade.
Wow.
So, this woman obviously had tenure at that point. They weren't firing her, so they moved me over to another class.
Right.
So, yeah, I still have nightmares about that woman, Mrs. Rush.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I kind of had a teacher like that in third grade, but nothing like that, just as far as like that punishment mentality.
Yeah.
Was she old?
Yes, she was very old. Yes.
My third grade teacher was ancient. Right. And it was just like she had seen enough of that system and she decided she was going to take it out on the kids.
Right.
The other kids got it too, I assume, in your classroom?
Yes, but not nearly as bad as me. I was the only one that got switched.
Right. So. Did you ever feel okay in school after that, or was that just like
never
had a teacher that
a few years later I had a teacher that actually encouraged my love of poetry,
mm-hmm.
and short stories and science fiction, and she was just a great woman, very not nurturing, I wouldn't say that, but encouraging of my love of literature and poetry. And so she kind of helped me to reestablish a bit of faith in the public school system.
Right.
But I always had trust issues with teachers.
I can imagine. Yeah, absolutely.
And then as a follow-up, my college experience, I was very into video. Mm-hmm. In my latter years of high school. So I was very artistic. I was taking classes at an art school in Philadelphia on Saturdays, and you know, got very encouraged there from the art professors, my illustration teacher, to pursue my film and video studies.
Mm-hmm.
So I was accepted to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
which is a world-renowned art school and all that. But the thing is, you can't take your major in your what they call a foundation year. You have to take this foundation year.
Like core curriculum kind of stuff?
Yes.
Yep.
3D design and illustration, which was no problem for me, but sculpture and drafting and all these technical things that I really had no interest in.
So the idea is that you get a broad sweep of everything that the arts can be.
Yes.
In case you want to make a different decision.
Right.
Just like that's why school is so great, because it exposes you to all these different things.
Right.
That's what they say.
So I didn't make it through that foundation year.
Really? You know,
I dropped out after the second semester, and I tried to transfer to the Art Institute of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And by that time, I had discovered all the other things that Philadelphia had to offer a 18-year-old boy, you know?
Yeah.
The not-so-educational pursuits, shall we say.
I discovered them in college, and it was a real derailment.
Yep. So, needless to say, by the end of that little sojourn to the Art Institute, which didn't even last a single semester, my college career was over.
And what did you do?
Well, that was the time that a whole group of people from my part of New Jersey moved en masse out to Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, I was very into the beat poets.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a page out of Kerouac's book and went on the road.
Right. Yeah.
So I spent about 2 years driving around back and forth. First, I drove to Oklahoma and back. Then I drove to Florida and back. And then by that time, people had started to migrate to Albuquerque. So then I drove to Albuquerque and I stayed there for about a year. And I had no education, so I couldn't get a job in anything other than restaurant work or landscaping.
Right.
So out of money, out of patience, out of frustration, I came back to New Jersey and got involved in the family business. And I'm still involved in it today. And it actually turned out for the best.
Indeed. Yeah, sure.
So, but, you know, hindsight 2020, I tried to resist being involved in the family business as long as I could. But in the long run, it's worked out for the best because, you know, my granddad started the business, and, you know, there's not many family businesses left that make it to the third generation.
Right. No, no,
beyond.
No.
So at this point, we're extremely successful at what we do. We are manufacturers of scientific glassware.
Yep.
So it's a really neat business, and very it's old world, it's new world, it's old technology, new technology, and you know, we sell worldwide, so I get to travel. So in the end, it worked out for the best.
So with that kind of having that foundation and having so many things, but I guess I'm trying. What's the right way to say this? Taken care of, right? Like, you could just put all your attention and energy into your business, into your family, but you have, you know, quite this impressive side scholarship going on. You have this awesome book collection in the hideaway here. Mm-hmm. And you know, you said you'd been at it since the 1990s, but it's still pretty intense for you. You read all the time. I saw where you sit on your couch and there's a huge stack of books next to you. Right. How did you start with that, and why is that so important to you? Like, what are you trying to discover or satisfy with all of this? I mean, you said one of the things I want to get into with you tonight was cybernetics, which you said is like one of the things you're most passionate about.
Right,
research.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you trying to satisfy with this work you do, when, like I said, you could put all your time and energy into it? I mean, you run this business at this point, right?
Correct.
And this
yes.
is a large business.
Yes,
but,
with my brother.
Yeah.
And my dad's still involved, but yes, for the most part. Mm-hmm.
So what are you looking for?
In a word, truth.
Okay.
that word that, you know, gets bandied about quite a bit, but it has weight for a reason.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if you don't know the truth about how the world works, then you're just playing a part. You're not writing the script.
Right. So how has the, like, let's laser in a little bit on cybernetics, right?
Sure.
Let's do a quick primer for people in my audience on what that is.
Okay.
What is cybernetics? Where does it come from? And maybe we can talk a little bit about how it's been applied.
Sure. Well, one thing that a famous cybernetician named Heinz von Forster mm-hmm. is famous for saying is that the more that you study it, the more obtuse it gets. Mm-hmm. Because it's not as cut and dry as other subjects. But for all intents and purposes, it goes back to Plato's Republic.
Yep.
The word, it comes from the Greek word, which is Kubernetes, mm-hmm. which is Greek for rudder, meaning an instrument to steer with.
Right.
So Plato, and from his point of view, there was a discipline, a concept known as the noble lie.
Right.
And the noble lie is, well, it's kind of like when Hillary Clinton got caught giving that speech to the Wall Street bankers last
mm-hmm,
year,
mm-hmm.
where she said you have to have a public persona and a private persona.
Yes.
So the noble lie is what the majority of the public believes to be the state of things, and then there's the reality.
And this is essentially what cybernetics creates?
And cybernetics is a system that allows the ruling class mm-hmm. to guide the ship of state.
Right.
Through various means and methodologies.
And this has been an active project in its most current form since when, about the end of World War II?
Correct. At the conclusion of the war, there was a series of conferences held in New York City, mm-hmm. sponsored by a foundation known as the Macy Foundation, mm-hmm. the Josiah B. Macy Foundation, which gathered the top minds of numerous disciplines together mm-hmm. to discuss a system of systems mm-hmm. for ultimately control. It's encompasses psychology, mathematics, engineering, the very earliest forms of AI,
yeah,
and computer science.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of an all-encompassing. It's known as the system of systems for a reason.
Have you ever tried to explain to people who were, you know, unfamiliar with this, how these types of designs are at play in their lives or affecting or steering their lives? If so, how did you do it and how did it go? Because, I mean, obviously education is a huge part of this
well. Yes.
You know, it's part of this enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so, I mean, you know, Jay Dyer and I recently talked about Tavistock, which sounds like it fits into this picture as well.
Mm-hmm.
But through your research, what really impacted you? What did you try to bring to other people, first of all?
Question.
Or is this just for your own?
Well, I have tried to share this with other people, and I always get that deer in the headlights look. Mm-hmm. I actually had recently, I was in Austin for a conference, and I got talking to a guy about politics, and he seemed, you know, from a liberty type discipline.
Yeah.
And as the beers went down and the night wore on, I started talking about cybernetics, and as soon as the subject was broached, this fellow was like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, everything since World War II has been planned.
Well, what were you talking about right before that? What made you, what gave you the green light on cybernetics?
Basically, the state of politics right now.
And you felt like you had some buy-in?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
I think one of the problems is that most people don't think in these kinds of systems, and they don't have these kinds of designs for other people, not consciously. Like, maybe if someone was given the choice, they'd like to manipulate certain people around them, like in their place of business or in their family dynamic or whatever. But most people just don't think this way. And this is the way that, you know, bad guys in movies think. So when you try to connect it to reality, it's like people are immediately conditioned to, if the story is complex, then it must be, if it's more complex than what they thought it was, then it must be false.
Exactly.
I think part of that is training, but part of that is also emotional. There's a comfort in resisting a lot of these narratives, and I think that's maybe what you experienced.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, no doubt, no doubt. Well, it's, you know, the very definition of conspiracy is when more than two people collude.
Right.
When the word comes, it literally means to breathe together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when you present these facts, even if you do it in a rational manner with examples and footnotes,
right, right.
The general reaction that you get is that it's just impossible. There's no way that this could be how reality is structured.
Right. Has this research changed your life, changed your behavior, changed your planning for the future or how you live in the present?
Oh, absolutely.
How so?
Absolutely. Well, it's driven me towards libertarianism,
mm-hmm.
to be sure.
That these kinds of plans are possible if power is more centralized?
Correct.
Right.
Right. But libertarianism is not exempt from that.
Right.
Power is power, and it seeks the top.
Yeah.
And the old saying about it corrupting absolutely is absolutely true,
mm-hmm.
Which has pushed me more towards anarcho-capitalism.
Right.
Because at least it's a decentralized way to conduct yourself and your affairs.
Mm-hmm. You were involved with libertarian party politics in the past?
I have been, and in light of recent events especially, it's given me pause to pursue that any further.
What recent events specifically?
Specifically, well, just the infighting in the party. The Gary Johnson presidency.
Is the infighting bad? I don't know. I kind of see it as good. Okay, so on the one hand, Gary Johnson was disastrous as a candidate, you know, carrying a pure libertarian message.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he... No, that actually makes it really bad because he exposed probably a lot of new people to libertarianism at a time where that message is needed, and he fucking blew it in just about every way possible.
Yes,
on
absolutely.
Every issue, and even took a lot of very like left-wing or progressive positions to try to cater to, you know, where he thought, I guess, a lot of young people were.
Right. He tried to make it more of a big tent philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was especially exemplified by his choice of Bill Weld as his running mate.
Good heavens, yes.
And
right.
We can see even now, this is a man that wrote his Pledge of Allegiance to the Libertarian Party on a napkin the day that he was to be announced as the vice presidential candidate. And he said in no uncertain terms that he pledged his allegiance to the Libertarian Party and to discount his previous associations with the Republicans. And this is a guy who did not attend a Libertarian fundraising event in his home state of Massachusetts so that he could attend a Republican fundraising event on the same day.
Jeez. Was there any indication of why or how Johnson rationalized picking him as the VP?
I think the rationale was if you had two candidates who had previously held elected office. It would be more palatable to newcomers to the party and to the philosophy.
Interesting. Okay. I knew there was a more practical reason. Like, I heard Gary Johnson say he was like Mr. Libertarian or something that was berserk. And so I knew there had to be another reason besides that. So, yeah, I think that this is something that obviously would push a lot of people who are more pure away and are not just looking for, you know, libertarians to gain a voice if it's not the right voice. Mm-hmm. But we were talking before about this. Before we move on to that, there in New Hampshire, I mean, this was a controversy for years that the tent was too big. And to get numbers, you know, New Hampshire, they had this free state project and they were trying to get 20,000 signers to get people moving. I think some, maybe around 1,500 people have moved, but they were trying to attract people who did not understand the philosophy. And in some places, in some parts of the state, the consequences of that were just disastrous as far as PR was concerned, where you say, oh, you like drugs and hate the cops, you come with us.
Right.
Those aren't necessarily, the right people to use to broadcast a message. So, and it did dilute the message, and it did cause a lot of fractures. If the effort had been to, you know, keep, I hate talking about like the purity of a message.
Right.
But when you see what happens when you do dilute it and you do try to make it a big tent. What's interesting now is that I'm listening to Dave Smith the other day, and he has a friend of yours on. What's this guy's name?
Michael Heiss,
and he started something called the Mises Caucus, right?
Correct. Yes.
And what is that?
Mises Caucus is an attempt to take back the leadership of the LP by replacing Nicholas Sarwark as the speaker of the party.
Right.
This is a guy who has attacked a lot of people in the Liberty Movement who have done more in the course of a single week than he's done in his entire career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's caused, again, more divisions.
Do you know where this guy came from, Sarwark?
He is a used car salesman.
No, come on.
Yes. He's also I've been told he's an attorney as well.
What kind of attorney is also a used car salesman?
Not one that I would hire.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. So, now, granted, he's rather charismatic and he has grace under fire, and he manages to keep his cool when he's being grilled on the whole issue that brought about all this division, and he stands by his convictions. Long story short, he posted a petition that he wanted people in the Liberty Movement to sign this petition that stated that you are against fascism.
Okay.
So one person in particular, that would be Tom Woods, said, there's no way that I would ever sign that. That's like signing a petition that says we agree that the sky is blue. Of course I'm against fascism.
Right, right.
What is this, like passing notes in junior high? Like, do you like me? Check here. You know, it just seems so juvenile and pointless.
Well, Tom sees it probably as virtue signaling, right?
Exactly,
but it's a sort of an empty gesture that's done for, you know, currying favor with people you shouldn't necessarily be concerned with, you know, currying favor.
Right.
I forget. Virtue signaling, we call it fruit bowling now. I don't know if you're up on this.
No, that's
okay.
A new one.
Okay. I'm really trying to get this to catch on, and we need to get word to like some of the bigger platforms. Like, I wouldn't take this to Tom Woods because it's kind of inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the fruit bowl? Do you know what this means?
No.
Okay.
No.
A fruit bowl is kind of hypothetical at best, but it's when a man tucks his parts between his legs so they come out the back, and then he turns around to show people this from behind while wiggling and saying, fruit bowl, fruit bowl. Now, when you do this, you are, on the one hand, being kind of vulnerable, but on the other hand, let's face it, you're kind of showing off. So, but what else is virtue signaling?
Right.
Besides that,
it's like, that's a
so
fair
I thought
description. I'd say
this term virtue signaling is played out. We're tired of using this. We're tired of hearing other people use this. So I made up the fruit bowl. The first definition has existed. I first heard about that when I was in college. I don't think that's something people actually do. I think it's just more of an idea. But I said, you know what that is almost exactly like? Like, if you had to act out a virtue signal in real life, it would be this. So I would like people to start calling it fruit bowling now and just spread that around.
Let's
we put it on Urban Dictionary. So
nice.
You can go vote it up on Urban Dictionary. But yeah, so Tom didn't want any part of that.
Right.
And he, I think, is somebody who for years has, and I share this concern that the message has been diluted and kind of taken in another direction.
Correct.
And it's not that I'm not sympathetic to some aspects of that direction,
mm-hmm.
but it's the interesting challenge in all of this is something that Sarwark said about the way Rothbard and Hoppe designed their message, right? And
right.
I don't know if you heard what he said, but that it was to cater to, it was to attract racists.
Correct, yes.
To the Libertarian
Party. It was a dog whistle, I believe, was the term that he used.
Right, because of Hoppe's idea of, what were they, covenant communities?
Right.
Where you could basically segregate or stop people from moving into an area.
Right, right, right? Yes.
So that the entire Rothbard, or the Mises, I guess this is Mises, right?
Correct.
That they're the bad guys.
Right. Yes. That they're, I believe he used that, the term alt-right,
mm-hmm.
which if you know anything about any of the minds attached to the Mises Institute is about as far from the truth as you could possibly get.
Right. Because they're not nationalists.
Right.
So they're probably not white nationalists.
Right.
Okay.
And I mean, Rothbard himself was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So that blows that theory right out of the water.
But he did take a turn kind of to the right more at the end of his life, didn't he?
He did. Murray had several forays into the left and the right mm-hmm. during Vietnam.
Yeah.
He tried to build bridges to the anti-war left.
Yeah.
And he was the first one to admit that that was a bad course of action after it was all over.
Right.
And then later on in his career, he tended to lean more towards the Republican end of the spectrum.
Right. And this was around the time of the emergence of people like David Duke.
Right.
Right. Which
Correct.
Is why I think this association happens.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Jeffrey Tucker saying that he was working with Murray at that time and, you know, was skeptical, if not apprehensive, about him trying to, you know, bond or make an alliance with the, with these people on the right. So there is some truth to this.
There is. There is a bit, yes.
But I think Rothbard also realized that that didn't work.
Right. Sure.
Right.
I mean, this is a guy who was pretty much writing the script as he went along. There was no set of hard and fast rules.
Mm-hmm.
So he learned as he went.
Indeed. So as far as the Mises Caucus is concerned, the primary objective is to remove Sarwark. And what goes in his place, or what goes in place of the message that he's been trying to push?
Someone that understands the principles of libertarianism
mm-hmm.
As they have evolved over the years and how we should go forward. And that's a return to a more pure set of ideals.
So they want somebody who is more the part of Ron Paul, who wherever he has to go to fit in or to project a message, he's taking his notes from something like For New Liberty.
Correct, yes.
More than whatever. I don't know much about Sarwark's philosophical background, but he seems like the Libertarian political party has been disastrous the entire time.
Oh yeah,
I followed it. I mean, mm-hmm. do you remember the Republican guy, Wayne Allen Root?
Root? No, I'm not familiar with him.
I think he was the guy. They grilled him on Free Talk Live until he admitted that he was supporting Mitt Romney or something. I don't remember all the details. And
facepalm.
Exactly, exactly. But this is what happens when I don't work off notes for interviews, because I mm-hmm. said, how would you change your life because of your revelations about cybernetics? You said you became a libertarian.
Right, right,
and
right.
And so 12 minutes later or so, we're here.
Right.
So that was one example of ways your thinking changed or your actions changed as the result of this research that you did, that there's a kind of hidden rudder that is responsible for the direction of humanity, which is something that we've, you know, certainly covered in one form on my show. I obviously took a lot of that from Gatto's work,
right.
From the work that Richard Grove had done on the subject before.
Correct.
I did. But I'm with you on that. I think it moved me in the same. I mean, I found the libertarian message through my feelings about education. I think for a lot of people, it's the opposite. Like, education is something that you kind of pick up on once some of the basics of, you know, either the economics are in place, or, you know, the attitude towards foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Education is usually not the first stop for people, but it was for me because I had this experience. I encountered Gatto in the work of a few similar people outside of, you know, the libertarian lens. Mm-hmm. But, you know, through that, and through my own experience there, in some pretty, you know, unfortunate situation, seeing kids basically be drugged into these, you know, placid or near placid states, great consequence to them. This wasn't about, you know, the freeing of the individual's mind. Right.
Right.
And even right. And even when I went on to, you know, work at some of the schools that people talk about of the privileged, because they're, you know, they're wealthy and they live in the right towns. It was different, but it was just a different conveyor belt that they were on going to a different place.
Right.
Sure. And I never felt through anything that I did, if I was doing what I was supposed to do at the behest of the teacher or behest of the curriculum, I didn't feel like I was doing anything to serve the students. And it was a slow process from there that got me to embracing libertarianism through being exposed to people like Wes Bertrand and his show Complete Liberty or Free Talk Live. And then all of these feelings that I had been having about school just started to make sense when it fit into that picture.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting in front of the fire here. What other changes for you as a result of this research?
Well, basically my entire outlook on the world. I knew from my previous research that there was this overarching, I cringe to even say the word, conspiracy. But it put more of a fine point on it once I discovered how pervasive and all-encompassing these programs of social engineering are in our society.
Because it's out of the abstract. Right. You talk about this. What was this post-World War II event that took place in May?
The Macy Conference.
Macy Conference.
Correct.
Now, you told me that you had been reading through the minutes of these meetings.
I just purchased it's almost a 700-page book, which is the entire – well, it's the minutes of the cybernetics portion of the Macy Conferences from 1946 to 1952.
Mm-hmm.
Although it says right in the foreword that certain portions have been redacted.
Okay.
And right in the foreword, a few key words jump out, like operant conditioning and social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, those are hallmarks of what's the word I'm looking for here?
Well, scientific management, for sure.
There you go. Yes, scientific management. It's not in the best interest of the average everyday person. It's in the best interest of the people that run society.
Well, they would make the argument, as they have done since the late 1800s, that the everyday person doesn't know what's in their best interest.
Correct.
And if everybody was just left to pursue what they thought, you know, in their flights of fancy, were their best interests, the world would be a chaotic hellhole.
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
So human beings, and it's almost like, I find it just curious how the schools were set up in this country and took this progressive turn, you know, first in the 1850s and then this reformation that happens around the turn of the 20th century as, you know, something that's going to have this great civilizing effect that's right. necessary, right? It's the same story then right. that people are deeply irrational and dangerous, mm-hmm. and they need a system like this to standardize them and make them safe to each other and to themselves,
mm-hmm.
right?
Absolutely.
But then after this system is in place for just a couple of generations, the plans for new types of management are so much more advanced and so much more sophisticated and apparently so much more necessary, right, than just the designs for the schools were a couple generations earlier.
True,
so
yes.
is school, and I don't know the answer, was school a stepping stone to, because, you know, we talk about, you know, these types of plans or designs going all the way back to Plato's Republic, right?
Right, yeah.
So there was... I'm not saying there's continuity there, but the need for this kind of programming was understood for a long time.
Sure.
Were the schools a step, or were the schools a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy? You know, they're not, were the schools part of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Like
symptom thereof, perhaps? Or?
Well, the schools make the further steps necessary, right? Mm-hmm. Because what is the output of the schools? People who are not really self-sufficient in their thinking, right?
To say the least.
When you see people who aren't self-sufficient in their thinking, you say, well, shit, we need some helping hands here,
right?
You know? So bring in the science to, you know, make these people live correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what the answer is. If that's more of a Fabian strategy that begins with, well, it doesn't even begin with the schools, but the schools are a precursor to some of the cybernetics developments of the early and mid 20th century.
Sure.
Or
you can read that in the works of William Torrey Harris and some of the early educators mm-hmm. of this country about the need to civilize the masses.
Exactly.
And to turn out, what's the phrase? I don't want thinkers, I want good workers.
Sounds like John Rockefeller.
There you go. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Right, right.
The Woodrow Wilson quote that I've said on the show 100 times. We want one class of people to have a liberal education. Well, the impulse that predates any of the stuff that we're talking about is control, you know?
Yeah. That's
and right. It seems like as time marches on, the justification for it and the tools for achieving it just become increasingly sophisticated.
Right.
Right? Yes. But I mean, this goes back to even before the schools, this desire exists mm-hmm. to steer people how fucking convenient.
Right.
To steer people as a whole mm-hmm. in one direction. I mean, we see this, full force in the early decades of the 20th century in the work of somebody like Bernays, right?
Oh, and without question.
How popular was that guy with the U.S. government mm-hmm. and big corporations? Because
right.
he could do exactly that.
He had it figured out down to a science.
Indeed. Yes. And when you see the existence, not just the existence of somebody like that doesn't do it, but the success and how seriously that he was taken, mm-hmm. I think it should lend a lot of credibility to some of these other discussions.
Without question. Probably the most basic of examples is bacon and eggs, because he was hired by corporations that sold pork bellies to move their product. So
right.
he came up with a simple catchphrase, no American's day morning is complete without a bacon and eggs breakfast.
Yep.
And
oh shit, that's what I had for breakfast this morning.
Damn. See that, man?
Yep.
They gotcha.
But this was at a time when there were serious doubts that these things were actually good to eat, right?
Right?
And this, I mean, and this persisted until, 15, 20 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And it still persists.
Sure.
Right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
But there was a time where he was massively successful with this campaign, with getting women to smoke.
That's a big one, too, yeah. Liberty sticks, or Liberty torches, I believe he called it, during a suffrage march. He handed out Lucky Strikes and had the women leading the march all light up cigarettes at the exact same moment. And it was very cosmopolitan for women to smoke just like a man could. But really what they were doing was trying to double their market share.
Mm-hmm. What's scary about it is how effective he was on with just optics alone. Right. Like just mm-hmm. making something look the right way was all it took to convince millions of people to do a
That's
thing.
Almost how easy it is.
It's like
every day.
Yeah. It's like he was Donald Trump's teacher. Right. Because you hit people on this emotional level
mm-hmm.
and they'll make the decision in the moment. They'll make the decision.
Oh, yeah.
They'll decide what direction they're going immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And then as rational beings, they'll say, oh, shit, I'm not supposed to do that.
Right.
So
you play the emotion card first.
Right. And then you fill it in later with some kind of rational sounding.
This
you know,
is true. I wish Daniel was here. He's the expert on Bernays, Daniel McCarthy
mm-hmm.
from Ohio, who you're going to see in a few days.
Right.
So I hope that you guys will flesh this out a little bit more.
You guys talked about Bernays in Salem?
Yes. Yes. And then afterwards we've communicated quite a bit. We talked about brainstorming on maybe doing a show together on propaganda and cybernetics. So maybe
that's terrific.
We'll get to that sometime. Yeah,
like awesome. Starting a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Or one of us, one or the other, doing it, and then guest starring on the other one's show, or teaming up to flesh this out a little bit more.
You feel like you have enough to say to put in a weekly show on cybernetics?
Weekly? I don't know. Rich was just telling me I should pursue that, though. Maybe not weekly, but, semi-regularly, maybe.
What kind of resources would you incorporate? What are the best resources to get somebody started on this subject? Because I think what's interesting here is, again, it's out of the abstract. It's into the concrete. This Macy thing that you were telling me about sounds fascinating. I'm sure it goes beyond the forward in the book. You said you had a highlighter out, right?
Right.
You were taking lots of notes.
Correct.
Any other interesting discoveries from that set of minutes?
Oh, actually, I just got the book about less than a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm only up to about page 30.
Mm-hmm.
I plan to, you know, really dig in and extract as much, much information as I can. There's some materials that are out in the public sector that, back this theory up. One of the actual, intellectual who coined the modern term cybernetics was a mathematics professor at MIT by the name of Norbert Wiener.
Mm-hmm.
And, he wrote a book called Cybernetics or Control and Communication in the Animal and the Machine, which is a very obtuse book to get into if you're not a math major.
Oh, really?
A lot of equations, a lot of diagrams, a lot of inside baseball mathematical type writing. But then his next book was called The Human Use of Human Beings. And I can't think of a more on-the-nose title when talking about the subject of cybernetics than that.
Right.
I mean, there it is. It's case closed, you know.
Yeah, it connects to me, like, to Taylorism, for sure. Mm-hmm. What was that? What was that other documentary, Human Resources, was it called?
Human Resources.
I think it's like a documentary series, and, uh-huh. it goes through this, uh-huh. human beings as resources, uh-huh. pretty much.
Right, right. I'll have to check that out.
So let's go back to you trying to, if need be, like, let's say you do try to pursue this as a podcast format.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things that I think would make this more concrete for people is connections to today. So how do we see in our current world, whether it's cultural, political, or technological, the evidence of cybernetic success?
Well, the internet.
Okay.
The internet is probably the most ubiquitous example. It's something that people voluntarily take part in.
Mm-hmm.
It serves as a form of surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
It logs data.
Mm-hmm.
It does connect people, which cybernetics is very specific in how systems of systems work, how things are connected, how feedback loops are created.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet itself is a type of feedback loop. Energy gets put in and energy comes out.
What does feedback loop mean in this context?
Facebook is a good example, I think, mm-hmm. of a feedback loop because you can, you know, get into a discussion with someone or mm-hmm. post something
mm-hmm.
and then you get responses back to it
mm-hmm.
and it creates a self-perpetuating system. And as much information as you put into it and promote it, almost as much as you get out.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook itself is probably the most obvious example of what the cyberneticians were trying to impose upon society because it is the ultimate surveillance tool.
And it groups people beautifully. as many aspects of the internet do.
Absolutely, sure. And another aspect to this is the concept of the panopticon.
Indeed, sure.
Especially, not that it wasn't a good thing that Edward Snowden made his revelations.
Right.
But as a result, I think that people self-police because you never know who's watching.
You think people self-police?
Yes, correct.
In what ways?
By not being as outspoken about perceived wrongs or injustices as they would be if they didn't think that in some government facility somewhere all this was being dutifully
right. okay.
taken
so,
down.
So it sets up the panopticon mindset in people
correct.
Just by putting this information. All right, so there were a couple of different theories that I think, I forget who I was talking about this with when all this happened, that it did have that, it had that kind of chilling effect.
Right.
Right, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was really footloose and fancy free on Facebook, I think, before that happened. And I mean, in the internet, obviously, still is.
Sure.
But I think that absolutely, for people who already had those concerns, it might have had that effect. It might have had that impact.
Definitely.
The other idea with Snowden was it a kind of test, right, to see if people given this information would change their behavior, right?
Right.
And for the most part, it was hard to see that, you know, any drastic changes in behavior taking place after those revelations,
mm-hmm.
which just meant, okay, well, people can know this and they'll still behave the same way good to know, you know?
Right.
Yeah, with all this going on.
Duly noted.
And it was interesting. Rich did the film on Binney, right?
Right, yes.
Bill Binney, who was much higher up, directly inside the NSA. Mm. Snowden was a contractor. Mm. And that got zero media attention. So
isn't
was it
funny?
Because, Snowden was younger, because he had a hot girlfriend, or was it that simple? Or, right. And I hate to think that things are that simple. I also hate to think that, you know, it's more of a scheme. But it's interesting mm-hmm. that Binney's revelations were, I would say, more thorough.
Oh.
You know?
No doubt.
Mm-hmm. And from a higher level.
Right.
But almost entirely ignored. I didn't know who Bill Binney was until Rich made the film, you know.
Nor did I. Well, that's not true. I'd actually heard him on a Peace Revolution podcast when he talked about when his house was raided.
Oh, okay.
He was in the shower.
Then I'll amend that, too. I didn't hear about Binney until Richard Grove
did
something.
Yeah, it was through Rich, ultimately.
Right,
yes,
right.
Indeed.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that whole picture is really useful if you thought about how to create a podcast and build an audience around that doesn't quickly turn into an echo chamber, right, where people are going to just have, you know, their suspicions or their conclusions reinforced.
Right.
That there is actually, I thought this was really useful, like some of the Tavistock stuff, as a way to build credibility towards the school story, right? Like any evidence of any concrete evidence of social engineering plans, at least provides people a framework or a context to understand the design of public schooling in America and in Europe before that, and you know, in Europe and around the world concurrently.
Right.
So I think that. Because of the concreteness of some of the cybernetic research mm-hmm. and the records of it, it's attractive because it is conspiratorial and it does have that kind of intrigue to it.
Sure.
But there's also a lot of concreteness to it.
Absolutely.
That could help, I think, a lot of people rethink the world, right? And become a more active participant
mm-hmm.
Or a more conscious consumer of the world around them.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly what appealed to me when I first heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
It put a name on what I had always suspected.
Right. That had always just existed in this nebulous state.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you were eating that stuff up. If you had that appetite, you were probably eating that stuff up.
Oh,
if there were any detail to it, right, in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
it's like, this is what I've been looking for. This brings something into focus.
Yes, I probably listened to that episode. I could even tell you it's episode 061 of the Peace Revolution podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 6.5 hours long, and I probably listened to it 20 times. Then I went on to Rich provides copious footnotes to everything he does. So I went to the show notes and I followed up on every single segment of that podcast and, got the proof that I needed to continue researching.
Absolutely.
And specifically with the work of Patrick Wood. Are you familiar with
him? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Technocracy, which
yep.
I think dovetails completely with cybernetics.
Mm-hmm.
If the two aren't mutually exclusive, then I don't know a different term to categorize them. Technocracy evolved as a separate discipline from cybernetics
mm-hmm.
About 10 years earlier, and the movement was quite popular after the Depression when people were very down on capitalism. It kind of petered out on its own for various reasons. The guy that was the the figurehead was discovered to have padded his resume and mm-hmm. proven to be a fraud. You know, whether or not those ideas were absorbed and expounded upon by the Macy conferences, I tend to think they were. I don't have that connection yet,
mm-hmm.
but just by studying the two separate disciplines, I think that's absolutely the case.
Fascinating. You've kind of inspired me to start cracking the books on this, because I think it would really bolster some of the other work that I've done. And I think this is something that I could be, without like straying too far away from the mission of my show, especially if we talked about defenses mm-hmm. against this, especially for young people.
Sure.
Like I could get into this mm-hmm. for a while.
Great.
So the fire is almost out.
Yep.
Can we do one more segment?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Originally, the format for these interviews was just these two very open-ended questions
Oh, hell yeah. What is this?
Stoke the fire.
Oh, stoke it. Yeah, sure.
Watch out. Some sparks might fly here.
Yeah, no problem. So originally the format was just these two open-ended questions. This your school sucks story, which is the shorthand for that, and your plan of action once you realize that. But as I was driving today, I said, you know, I'm going to add a third segment. I'm going to let listeners do an Ask Me Anything and just see what kind of questions I get. And what kind of ideas that might generate for things that it could be, and it could be anything. I'm not trying to put pressure on you to come up with something magical here, but like, what kind of things have I never thought about talking about on the show that people might be interested in hearing about?
Well, the thing that comes to my mind, and it's something I've always loved about your show, is the sound effect of the school bell.
The school bell. Yep.
Yes. It's a sound that everyone knows because we've been conditioned to respond to it. And I know that when I hear it, it tells me that class is about to begin. Did you consciously choose to use that sound drop on every episode in that way?
I did, but sometimes I use it just as a kind of a punctuation mark, right? Like in the beginning, it didn't mean class was about to begin. Even though when I started doing the show, I had much more of a teacher mindset and much less of a learner mindset. Like I'm almost all learner mindset today, right? I've been humbled by exposing myself to the world and, or not to the whole world, but to people in the world who are very, very bright, you know? And I'm just realizing that because I could put a sentence together in front of a classroom, I was like, oh, well, I'll probably have the best fucking podcast too, you know? So if you listen to like the first, I don't like 20 episodes of School Sucks. I really sound like I'm taking a very similar tone to how I took when I was standing in front of a classroom talking to teenagers. And because, well, that's also who I was trying to talk to when I started the show.
Right.
But then I think it was like getting a lot of really bright people from like the Freedom Main audience and having a lot of crossover with Wes's show, Complete Liberty, and really coming in contact with some very, very bright people that I realized that, oh, I'm speaking to peers here, right? And I'm complimenting myself in many cases to call some of these people peers. So I better change my tone. Now, the irony there is that the bell, even in the beginning, even when I had this teacher tone to the show, it wasn't to say class is beginning, because that's what school does. It's to say school is dismissed, right? To me, it was important. Sometimes, like, I've just kind of stuck it at the end of the show for effect, but it seemed like it should go at the beginning of the show, like, this isn't school, school's out, you know? That was actually why I chose to use it as a sound effect, and I've thought about retiring it from the show several times or replacing it with the more modern bell that just goes, doo!
right. I wouldn't do that if I was you.
No, I don't think I think at this point it's, you know, it's been in 550, 560, maybe more shows. So it's there to stay, but it announces this is beyond school, you know. That was why I chose it. And nice. it does work for, like I said, punctuation and dramatic effect and, you know,
without question.
Timed to go with whatever music I choose for the show. I realized, like, if you move it around in the editing program, like, sometimes just an eighth of a second one way or the other makes a huge difference in like with the song, and the impact that it actually has, which I was kind of an interesting discovery. Like, I'd put it in at one point in a song and I'd be like, oh, that sounds like shit, and I'd slide it like an eighth of a second and I'd be like, oh, fuck yeah. So
made all the difference in the world, right?
That's the story with the bell.
Nice. So, thanks for that explanation.
Yeah, no problem. Well, Phil, it's been a fantastic conversation, and I'm so grateful to you for sharing your home with me on this, the third day of School Sucks Across America. Amen. It's been great to get to know you over the last few months, and I hope we can continue to do this. I don't know if it'd be easier to get here in a boat. I'm not a fan. For me, in the quiet of New Hampshire, the drive down here seems a little harrowing.
Right.
But
right.
I'm glad you're close, and we should definitely do something like this again.
Oh, yeah, it's been nice getting to know you these past few months. Looking forward to many more years of collaboration here.
Well, thank you so much.
No worries, Brett.